org.
Hi, this is former presidential candidate Mitt Romney. Now, I may have made some missteps on the campaign trail, but I would never miss the Capitol Steps New Year's special. It might give the Republican Party some new ideas on appealing to more voters.
What's the Spanish word for blue? Could this be our swan song?
So listen to the Capitol Steps New Year's special on this public radio station.
New Year's Day at 1.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you, along with Bonnie Berman. Today we begin with language usage and insight with writer Constance Hale. She's now written a third book about the subject, this one devoted to verbs. Transitive or intransitive, possession, abstract, or emotional. And her book is called Vex, Hex, Smash, Smooch, Let Verbs Power Your Writing. And she joins us from Oakland. Welcome to you, Connie Hale. Say hello to Bonnie Berman.
Hello.
Hey, Bonnie. It's the Bonnie and Connie hour, huh?
That's it.
How do you feel about the description of you as E.B. White on Acid? Of course, he was the great editor and children's writer and the co-author of Elements of Style.
Well, you know, it's kind of like Nirvana. If anybody calls you to compares you to E.B. White, no matter on acid or off. But the other description that went along with that was Marion the Librarian on a Harley. That fits.
That's good. Connie, when did you develop your passion for language?
Well, you know, it started early for me. I had a strange upbringing in Hawaii. I grew up in a little sugar plantation town on the north shore of Oahu, which is the surfing capital of the world, and we spoke a Hawaiian Creole in my village. My parents spoke standard English. My parents were both from the mainland, and they spoke proper English at home and at the dinner table and insisted on it from us. And then we would go outside on the beach or in the sugarcane fields or school, and we would speak Hawaiian Creole. And I think that I was bilingual in English, and I think really that that's when I started to love, I loved the back and forth between standard English and pidgin English, even as a child, and then that interest or fascination in standard English and non-standard English just kept snowballing as I grew older.
And your parents never spoke the pidgin English, just the standard English?
Well, pidgin English is something, Hawaiian pidgin English is something that you can't really learn. And that was the joke, was my parents were always, you know, insisting on proper grammar and we had to speak their way, but they couldn't speak our way. So it was kind of like, well, you know, why you make me talk like that? And then they didn't have anything to say. So
yeah,
it was
give us
kind
another,
of
a little more example of that, maybe a sentence or two of pidgin Hawaiian.
Oh, the story of Little Red Riding Hood and pidgin begins this way. Little Pohi went come home from school one day, and her mother went tell, you know, your tutu been stay very sick. More better you go take her some cookies or something.
Oh, my.
There you go.
Almost sounds different. A little bit like Haitian Creole or pidgin.
A lot of people, when they hear it, compare it with Jamaican English, mm-hmm. Yeah, or, you know, some kind of Caribbean English. It's right. A Creole.
Now, you also still dance the hula. Is that on your Facebook page or website?
It is. There's a picture of me, I think, dancing hula on my Facebook page. I do. I grew up dancing it, and I found someone in San Francisco that has an official hula troupe, and I've been dancing it here in San Francisco for 16 years.
Just to carry on about the pidgin English, do you ever find occasion to speak it anymore?
Oh, sure, when I go home. I mean, you know, there's sort of heavy pidgin and light pidgin, and what I notice is the minute I go home, sometimes literally the minute I step off the airplane and I hear someone speaking, maybe even just slight pidgin, there's this kind of, it's almost like when two, you know, in the old days when you used to use a modem and you'd hear two telephones talking to each other, that's kind of, it happens like that. You hear someone say something and then your language adjusts a little bit and then they adjust a little bit and all of a sudden you're in full-blown pidgin.
Well, let's get back to verbs. How about the ing verbs or gerunds? They put you in the passive voice, so when are they most effective? Of course, in broadcast, we try and stay away from those and stay very simple subject, verb, object.
Well, that's interesting. You know, you go right, you know, Joe, you're going right to tone and the way that different forms of verbs change the tone of what you're writing. So I would imagine in broadcast journalism, especially if you're doing the news, you want to have a simple tone. You want to be direct. You want to be as direct and to the point as possible. On the other hand, some of those ing words, they could be gerunds, which are verbs acting as nouns, or they could be participles, which are verbs acting as adjectives. They can give a certain rhythm to the language that I quite like. So it's sort of a difference between, well, you know, do you want to speak in iambic pentameter or do you want to speak in anapestic rhythm? I mean, all of these syllables in English give us the chance to make different rhythms, and then those different rhythms in turn affect tone. So sometimes you'll find that if you're using a lot of gerunds or participles, the language kind of unfolds differently. It might even be a little more lyrical as opposed to sort of punchy, direct, straightforward verb. So it's just a lot of what I'm trying to get across in this book is that we have words are almost like arrows in our quiver. You know, as writers, we can, maybe I'm mixing a metaphor there, but you know, there's so many ways that we can control language if we understand the way words work. And fundamentally, this book is about.
I remember the example given to me, say, of the active voice is the cat ate the rat. And the passive voice is the rat was eaten by the cat.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, the passive voice gets a bad rap. Everybody, you know, you learn in journalism school, they probably have told you, don't use a passive voice.
Right.
Well, I have a whole chapter on the passive voice because my attitude is everything in language exists for a reason. And, you know, in journalism, there are times when you have to use the passive voice. Say there's a fire in a house and the baby ends up outside the house and no one knows who carried the baby out. Well, you better say the baby was carried outside the house because you don't know whether a firefighter did it or the next-door neighbor or the parent. So that's where the passive voice is really helpful, useful.
You call verbs the fulcrum and the heartbeat of every sentence. Do you feel that verbs are not adequately regarded or used to their full potential by most of us?
You know, I think a lot of us sort of tense up when we hear words like verbs or gerunds or participles. A lot of us, for whatever reason, didn't really learn grammar, or maybe they tried to teach it to us and we turned a deaf ear to the lessons. And so I think Americans in particular kind of have this anxiety about English, and what I try to do is say, wait, it's really not that hard. Every sentence has a verb, and really the verb is what the sentence is about. The dramatic action in the sentence is embedded in the verb. So it's not that hard to learn what they are and to recognize them. That's step number one. Step number two is to ask yourself, ooh, have I picked the best verb possible? Have I picked the best voice? Have I picked the best tense? So it's just a process of first being able to identify the verb, then being able to understand how many verbs there are to choose from, and then to be able to moderate tone and rhythm, as we were speaking about before.
So how do we go about hunting down a good verb? Should we begin with the verb rather than the noun when composing a good sentence?
Well, I think, you know, I usually say compose. It's so hard for so many of us to write anyway. It's hard to get our ideas out on paper. So I think, you know, just the first draft is always just getting the ideas out, and I encourage people not to trip out too much about their sentences. Just let the sentences roll out in whatever way is natural to you. But then in the rewriting, it's all in the rewriting. So then you go back and you look at the sentence and you say, okay, where is the verb? Particularly if you feel like a sentence is just dead, if the sentence doesn't have the liveliness that you want, go to the verb first, for sure. What's the verb? Have I picked the best verb? Who's doing the thing? That takes you to the subject. And just straighten out that relationship between subject and verb, and is this really the best way to kick off the sentence? Is this the best way to do it? And then the other parts of the sentence sort of fall into place after you do that work.
You used the term, Connie, predicate etiquette. Describe that.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is the notion of just the structure of sentences. And we're really kind of lucky in English. We only have five basic sentence patterns, so it's not that hard really to figure out the structure of any sentence. Find the verb, and then from the verb, go find the subject, and then that will make it pretty obviously subject, verb, what the object is, if there's an object in a sentence. Not all sentences have objects. And predicate etiquette is just a joke, really, because a lot of people don't understand objects, you know, direct objects, indirect objects, don't know how to find them. But if you can find the verb and then find the subject, you can find the object pretty easily. And there are some little grammatical rules about subjects and objects. So if you can figure out those three relationships, you can figure out, for example, whether to use who or whom, whether to use me or I. That's helpful sometimes.
what are some of the most common mistakes we make with verbs? Like, what habits should we try to avoid?
I mean, the main thing is most of us overuse is and are. For some reason, the way our sentences tumble out naturally, we rely a lot on is and are. And I think if there's one thing you could change in your speaking and your writing, you could look at that habit and try to use a different verb. So, for example, I remember when I was watching Deadwood, the HBO series a couple years ago, and the mayor of the town spoke, E.B. Farnham spoke in this kind of Shakespearean, this kind of wonderful Shakespearean language. And one time the widow, I think her name was the Widow Garrett, she was coming down the stairs. Now, your average person would say, there she is. That's what we would all say when seeing someone walking down the stairs. He said, she enters. And I love that example. Mm. All of a sudden, it's more dramatic, it's more exciting, and that's just the difference between a sentence that has is as a verb and there as a subject, which is a totally boring sentence, and she enters. All of a sudden, we know the focus is immediately on she and what she's doing, and we get that image of her.
That's a great example. Do you have another one?
Well, an example, I think a lot in descriptions, people think, oh, descriptions, those are all about nouns and adjectives, right? If I'm doing a scene or if I'm describing a character, we focus on nouns and adjectives. But if you think about it, think about some shoes that are outside the door and you're just describing the front of a house. The shoes are outside the door, you could say. Well, you know, there's nothing wrong with that, but what if you say the shoes wait outside the door? Or what if instead of the shoes, you say the boots? And then you say the boots slouch outside the door. Or the Doc Martens stand at attention. All of a sudden, inanimate things, yeah, are becoming characters in your little drama. It's interesting. You're telling, even in one little sentence, you're beginning to tell a story.
Right. We're speaking with Constance Hale. Her latest book is Vex, Hex, Smash, Smooched. Smooch. It's a tongue twister. And it's on today's Topical Currents. We're going to take a short break. Stay with us, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and 91.5 WKWM NPR for the Florida Keys.
Miami Children's Theater presents Disney's The Little Mermaid, December 14th through the 29th at the Alper JCC in Kendall. In what has become a South Florida tradition, Miami Children's Theater pulls out all the stops in a fun-for-the-whole-family extravaganza. Huge sets and lavish costumes combine with a remarkable cast as Miami Children's Theater tells the tale of Ariel, Sebastian, Ursula, Prince Eric, and all your favorite Little Mermaid characters. Tickets at MiamiChildrensTheater.com.
Edward Siaga was Prime Minister of Jamaica and also a famous music producer. Two things that come together in what he calls Jamaica's greatest accomplishment.
Our music has been the greatest because it has made us a brand name throughout the world.
We talk about reggae's golden jubilee next time on Tell Me More from NPR News.
Tonight at 8 p.m.
Like Topical Currents' Facebook page at facebook.com/topicalcurrents. Join the conversation, post a comment, share links, and see what other listeners are saying at facebook.com/topicalcurrents.
And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. We continue our conversation with writer Constance Hale, Connie Hale. And her book is Vex, Hex, Smash, Smooch, Let Verbs Power Your Writing. Well, let's say in the title, Connie, kind of a captivating verb. I guess everyone likes to smooch a little bit, so it's some great alliteration.
Absolutely, and I picked these four verbs. It is a little bit of a tongue twister, as you just noticed, but these four verbs actually tell a lot of the story of English, which is kind of the subtext of the book. I mean, the book is really about verbs and it's about writing, but it's also about the history of English and the way English works. So I love these four verbs because vex comes to us from French, and before that, Latin. Hex is an invention in the Americas. It's sort of sprung up out of Pennsylvania Dutch. Smash, we don't really know where it came from, but sometime in the 1850s, someone smashed smack and mash together and created a new word, which is very common now, and we love it because it's has some onomatopoeia in it.
Right.
Sounds like the thing it describes. And then there's smooch, which is actually slang. But what a fun word. So that's, in a very brief way, it kind of signals or telegraphs the subtext of the book, which is that we have this amazingly rich language, and we have so many verbs to pick from, all with a little history and story of their own, and all of which make different kinds of rhythms. I mean, again, going back to that earlier point, that we want to be able to play with our verbs so that have some control so that we can play with rhythms and sound in the sentence.
We're speaking with Connie Hale. She's written, her latest book is Vex, Hex, Smash, and Smooch. And it's about verbs. If you have questions about verbs or you're writing and you'd like to talk to Connie Hale, our number is 1-800-743-9576. That's 1-800-743-WLRN. Or you can email your question to radio@WLRN.org. Connie, how do you feel about turning nouns into verbs? We had this big event here, most recently, the Art Basel, which I'm sure you've heard of.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big event in South Florida, and all of a sudden it became Baseling. So happy Baseling, and everybody knew what they were saying, but how do you feel about doing that?
Well, you know, there's a lot of people frown on that, nouning verbs. Ooh, we don't like, you know, that's not, a noun is a noun and a verb is a verb and never the twain shall meet. But the truth is that it's one of the great characteristics of English that we have. English is this incredibly flexible, supple language. And we can take a noun and turn it into a verb. And as you point out, we know what we're saying. So if I say I'm going to Google you, it makes sense. We didn't have a word, I suppose you could say I'm going to search for you. But that's actually vaguer than Googling, and you can go all the way back to Shakespeare and before that for lots of examples of nouns that have turned into verbs. I mean, think about babysitter. Well, we got babysit, or burglar, we got burgle. Shakespeare, one of my favorite examples from Shakespeare is dog them at the heels. I think that was Henry Bolingbroke, and we kind of get that image. It creates a metaphor. So I'm all for it. With a caveat, which is it really the best verb? I mean, it's we can turn a noun into a verb when there's no other available verb to say the same thing. But if there's an available word that's more precise and it's going to be clearer, well, that's the one we should use.
Okay. What are some of the other rules of grammar that you sort of defy, like ending a sentence with a preposition, splitting an infinitive?
Yeah, I don't know where that one came from. That's a couple centuries old that school teachers have been telling students not to do that. Actually, you can end a sentence on a preposition in English. It doesn't, again, the main thing is clarity. So sometimes if the object of the preposition is early in the sentence and then the preposition doesn't come until the end of the sentence, that can be, you can forget the object of the preposition, and those things do sort of work as a pair, so that's getting a little geeky, but I think that's why that rule came about, but it's a really misunderstood rule, and you can end a sentence on a preposition. You can start a sentence with a conjunction like and or but. Do it all the time. There's nothing wrong with it. Another one is, it's kind of outdated, but I was taught as a kid that you weren't supposed to split an infinitive, which means you're not supposed to take an adverb like boldly, and stick it in between the to and the verb. So you're not supposed to say to boldly go, even though they said that on Star Trek. But that's an old rule. Again, it's a rule that they kind of imported from Latin in the 1700s and insisted upon it in English, but it actually doesn't apply in English. And yet, for two or three centuries, teachers were telling people not to split infinitives.
But the preposition does govern the verb usage. You mentioned earlier about to whom or for whom. And if you go into the subjunctive, then you have if I were king. Because of the mm-hmm. if, you have to use the were.
Well, yeah, going back to the to whom and for whom, the idea there is the to is a preposition there. And a preposition is always followed by an object. So it's helpful to, so if you know that the preposition is followed by an object, well, you know that you're going to need whom, because whom is called the objective form of the pronoun. So to whom and for whom is correct. Now, what has happened, though, in English is we have started to lose our ear for that combination, and a lot of times when who is at the beginning of a sentence, we don't even if it's the object, we say who now instead of whom. So, you know, language does change, and I'm not opposed to the way language changes. I think it's all about clarity and naturalness. So, but at the same time, I kind of speak out of both sides of my mouth. I contradict myself because I think it's important to understand the way words, you know, I think it's very important. This is what we're getting back to, the predicate etiquette. It's pretty important to understand the way different words function in the sentence and the way the words in a sentence relate to each other, because when we get into trouble, it's when we write these long sentences and we lose that sense of like what's relating to who, and the sentence becomes really sort of jumbled and chaotic and the reader doesn't understand it. So we as writers need to do a little bit more work in making sure that all the parts are in the right place.
Well, Connie, mark my words now, we're going to have to take a call. This is Marilyn in Miami.
Hey, Marilyn.
Hi. I really appreciate your attention to verbs and verbal phrases. My question regards the common American usage of gonna have to, as in, I'm gonna have to talk to you, or I'm gonna have to go. And likewise, gotta go. You've got to go to sleep. You've got to get a copy, whatever. Where does that come from? It's, you know, if you spell it out, it's much longer. I am going to have to go.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't need to
say
that.
Well, certainly, you hit the nail on the head. When we speak, mm-hmm. we roll things together. They do that in all languages. I mean, go, like, hang out on the streets of Paris, and they mush all things, kinds of things together. Mm-hmm. But so that's pretty natural in speaking, that we want to speak more quickly, and we have different rhythms when we're speaking than when we're writing. And so gonna is just going to, and it's the difference between, you could say, standard English and non-standard English, or formal English and informal English. And so I personally don't think informal English is wrong. It's just informal English. So if you are hanging out with a friend and talking to a friend, it's, you know, fine to speak that way. If you're in a job interview or if you're trying to write an essay for the New York Times, you might want to think about whether you want, and again, it goes to this idea of tone and what you're communicating. So I sometimes very conscientiously use slang in my writing, as I do in the title of my book, Smooch. Sometimes a little bit of slang can telegraph a little looseness and you're sort of playing. On the other hand, if that's all you know how to do and you don't know how to maybe pull back and be a little formal or maybe a little more elegant or a little eloquent, it's nice to be able to do that too.
Oh, totally, but I still don't understand why it seems simpler in slang to say, I'm going to have to versus I must, because if you spell it out,
I think it's just habit.
Yeah?
Don't you think, Marilyn, it's just habit?
Speed.
We get into habitual ways of saying things, and it may or may not be more efficient, but it's just a habit.
Or thoughtlessness. But I appreciate your point.
Okay, Marilyn, thanks for your call.
Thank you. Sure,
and
bye.
We'll move along. We're getting short on time, so I ask our callers to be brief. This is Trevor in Boynton Beach. Hi.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I was wondering if you could just comment a little bit on, generally, on our use of active voice versus a passive voice. It seems that when we speak together, you know, in person, we're more apt to use an active voice. And then as soon as we go to write or you read, oftentimes people slip into a passive voice, and you know why is that?
That is
why
so.
Is it so
it's
hard
such
for
an interesting.
Us to do that?
It's such an interesting question. I think it has to do with the way we're taught to write. We're generally taught to write academic papers when we write in school, writing English papers and history papers. And I think we just slip into that. Again, it's a habit. It's it feels more academic maybe, and we slip into that. Also, sometimes I think we're not thinking creatively about how we could recast the sentence, but you can almost always recast something into the active voice, and it's a lot more fun to read something in the active voice.
Is the passive voice ever effective, though?
Absolutely. My favorite example is from newspapers, because I was a copy editor at newspapers years ago, and we weren't allowed to use the passive voice in a headline. So one time I was writing a headline for a pretty bad crime a criminal had just been convicted, and the headline that I wanted to write was I-580 Killer Convicted, because that was the I-580 Killer was the name of this heinous criminal who was driving along the freeway shooting people.
Right.
I thought that was a great headline, and it could have been in big type right above the fold. Well, we weren't allowed to use the passive, so I had to rewrite the headline so that it read, "Jury convicts I-580 killer." Much less powerful headline. All the focus goes on the jury. Nobody cares about the jury. What people cared about was the I-580 killer. So it would have been better in that case to use the passive voice.
How about a couple of historical examples of memorable verbs, say from Caesar, Lincoln, Churchill, Roosevelt?
Oh, well, of course, you know, Caesar, "I came, I saw, I conquered." Caesar's most famous quote is, you know, three verbs. "This is what I did in life." And there are probably a lot of epitaphs that feature verbs. The verbs in, you could go to Genesis, and the verbs are wonderful in the King James Bible. We've already mentioned Shakespeare. And by the way, Shakespeare was pretty fun because he invented a lot of verbs. I mean, this is another thing we think, oh, you're not supposed to invent verbs. You're not supposed to turn nouns into verbs. Shakespeare invented a hoodwink. He invented rant. He even invented puke. And so I think that's, Shakespeare's a great example. Lincoln's interesting because if you look at the Gettysburg Address, which is, of course, his most famous written speech, there's a lot of passive voice in there.
Connie, how about a website where people can learn more about you and your books?
www.sinandsyntax.com.
Sin and Syntax.
We only have a few seconds left, but you say that simplicity and clarity are not enough for good writing. Beauty should be a goal. How does one develop that ear for beauty?
Well, I think trying a lot of words, first of all. Try new words all the time because there are words that are more precise and more beautiful than maybe the one that pops out of your mouth first. And the second thing is play with sentences. Just try writing a sentence different ways, read it out loud, and see what sounds better. What sounds better to the ear usually reads better on the page.
Thank you, Connie Hill.
Thank you, Bonnie and Joe.
Thank you. The latest book is Vex, Hex, Smash, Smooch. Let verbs.
You better be careful.
Power
with those
your writing. Thank you very much.
You're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station.
Grandstand tickets are now on sale for the 64th Annual Junior Orange Bowl Parade, scheduled for December 30th at 4 p.m. Grand Marshal Ron McGill from Zoo Miami leads local and national marching bands, show horses, youth groups, performers, and floats down historic Miracle Mile in downtown Coral Gables. There's the pre-parade show, which is only available to grandstand ticket holders, with performances by local dance group Hip Hop Kids and the Bay High School Panama City Marching Band. More details at jrorangebowl.org.
Hi, I'm Michael Stock. Tune in Sunday to folk and acoustic music. I play the best in contemporary and traditional bluegrass, blues, gospel, and more, including interviews this week with Trett Fury, Eric Schwartz, and a look at the new publication of some old recordings of Florida folk music, Drop On Down in Florida. The Public Storyteller is at 4 o'clock. Folk and acoustic music, Sunday, starting at 2.
And we return this today's Topical Currents. Our Food and Dining Thursday has arrived. I'm joined by chef, author, syndicated columnist Linda Gastenheimer, the star of our program. Linda, it's the end of the year. The best to you and to yours and to Fred. So how about New Year's celebrations? I bet you have a handle on it.
I'll bet I do. Party, party, party. Mm-hmm. It's coming up. Well, we just had a long weekend, and now we're looking forward to another long weekend. So what's on the menu for New Year's? Is that what you're asking?
Yes.
Okay. Well, we've got a guest here who has some great ideas. She's the head mixologist at Hakkasan Restaurant at the Fontainebleau Hotel.
Mixologist. Is that a bartender?
Well, it's kind of a bartender educated a little more. You know your base spirits, you know ingredients, you work with the chefs. It's kind of like an illustrated bartender. It goes a little more beyond, you know how spirits are distilled, and it's a lot of work.
In all these years doing this program, you're the first woman who's had a knife close to me.
So, Joe, behave yourself.
You
better be good, Joe. I might hit you.
Well, that's the voice of Camille Austin. As I mentioned, she's the mixologist, the head mixologist at the Hakkasan restaurant in the Fontainebleau Hotel. Welcome, Camille.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
To be able to juggle like Tom Cruise to
I
be a mixologist?
I was wondering about that, too.
Well, you know, that's something different. That's flair bartending, which I'm working on right now.
Stuff, yeah.
But yes, Linda and I had this conversation a little earlier, but absolutely, you know, it's all about performance. So,
all right. And the other voice you heard, Fred Tasker, usual smile in his usual seat. As we all know, Fred is the wine columnist for the Miami Herald, and he writes the wine suggestions for my Dinner in Minutes column.
And he's got a bucket of ice in front of him.
He's got a lot
I always have a bucket of ice in front of me.
All right. So, in other words, let's go to Camille. Mixologist is not another term for bartender. It's a little more, huh?
It is a little more. You know, you have to just work really hard, attend all the seminars possible, you know, educate yourself. And it's our duty to educate the consumer and bring up this wine and dine culture with the regular consumer.
All right. So you've mentioned to me earlier that French 75 is a liquid masterpiece. How could a liquid be a masterpiece? And you've got it here in front of you. So tell us about it.
Absolutely. So French 75 is one of my favorite classic cocktails. Anybody who knows me well will know that. I just think bubbles are so posh and, you know, so girly. And I'm a big gin lover, so I made my little twist on a classic French 75. There's many stories about the origins of the French 75. I happen to like the one best about, you know, the soldiers that were fighting in France to the war, and they were trying to make a classic Collins but couldn't find any soda water anywhere, but there was just an abundance of champagne.
Oh, so, poor things, yes.
So they topped their gin, lemon juice, and sugar with some bubbles, and voila. So I made my own little twist that I make it at my bar all the time. I love it. In this case, I'm using an Oxley gin because it has 14 botanicals, and one of those being grapefruit. So it has really nice zesty.
Botanicals, you mean herbs?
Absolutely, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
People may not know that there's a lot of herbs in gin.
Oh, so many. And it actually has the same amount of calories as vodka, just has a little more character than vodka does because vodka provides neutrality. So I top it with a nice rosé champagne. My favorite is Laurent Perrier because I have to be nice. And
well, you've got some here in front of you.
I
and
do.
We're
would
waiting.
You?
You know, Fred's tongue's hanging out here.
Fred, would you like to do the honors?
Oh, we're going to open this? Okay.
He's got the champagne here. He's going to open the bottle. So French 75 is a set drink, basically gin, sugar solution, and a bubbly.
Absolutely. You can make it easily at home. The classic is just an ounce and a quarter of a nice gin. I prefer a nice citrus forward gin. Then you do just a half an ounce of fresh squeezed lemon juice, half an ounce of simple syrup, 1:1 sugar to water, and top it with a nice champagne and a lemon zest.
Okay, well, and that recipe's up on the website.
The rosé recipe, yes.
Are we ready?
Now, the secret to a true professional is that you can open a bottle of champagne without sending the cork across the room.
Well, I'm across the room.
Cheers.
He just sent the cork across the room. Fred Tasker, you know, champagne
for
you.
There's a first. I've got the bottle.
All right. So what are we drinking here?
So right here we have my nice variation. It's nice for the ladies during, you know, New Year's Eve, so they can have something beautiful and pink in hand.
Yeah, all right.
So we've got an ounce and a quarter of Oxley gin, a half an ounce of lemon juice, half ounce of simple, and then we're just going to layer it with rosé champagne and garnish with the grapefruit
zest. When you
zest.
Say you layer it, so first you put the drinks in. Have you made it here? Or?
Yes. I shook it right here for you, strained it into a champagne flute, and I'm going to take a bar spoon and just let that rosé champagne slide down the bar spoon.
On the top.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is complicated.
Right on the top.
So there's not a lot of champagne here. Okay.
Now, would I be allowed to try one, or is it only for the
certainly,
ladies?
Certainly.
She
please
said it's
do.
Girly, okay?
Well, I have.
Are you girly?
I have confidence in my
you have to hold up your little
masculinity.
You drink.
So. That takes a manly man.
All right. So what are the men going to drink?
Well, you know, a man, there's not really, I think cocktails are really unisex. There's not really a masculine or feminine to any cocktail.
Mm-hmm.
but I do like my pink, so I like my rosé French 75.
So you're the rosé. We've got a lot of calls coming in here.
You want to go there?
Yeah, line one. Is it Era of Miami Beach? Is that your name, Era?
Yes.
Okay.
Thanks for taking my call. So I was calling because I really love Saint Germain and also Champagne, and I was like a good combination cocktail to make with those two ingredients.
A good combination cocktail. Well, those actually pair really nicely together.
What is Saint Germain?
Saint Germain is a French liqueur. It's an elderflower cordial.
Okay.
It's really nice. You know, it also, it's made from all fresh ingredients. It's really, really well paired with champagne. You could do a little bit of citrus in there with some lemon juice. You don't need that much sugar because it's already a little bit of sweet. Just get creative. Use, you know, a fresh puree. You can even go a little tropical if you'd like with some mango, something nice and clean and crisp.
I guess she is more than a bartender.
Does that help you, Era?
Delicious. What about with some herbs?
Absolutely. Herbs pair really well with those liqueurs as well. Try some fresh basil, some mint. I really love rosemary is a little more pungent, but you can also do some maybe lemon thyme.
So you would put basil right into the drink?
Absolutely. You can get really creative. Wow. It's all about presentation. You know, it's about the drink tasting amazing, but also it looking beautiful and being appealing to the eyes. So you could leave those basil leaves in there, give this nice green popping color.
Okay.
Give it some aroma.
Thanks for your call, Era. We have Ed online too. Hello, Ed. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I had a similar question. I have a contribution. A favorite drink of mine lately has been the traditional mojito, but we were throwing in some dried cranberries and a couple of splashes of cranberry juice. That's become a favorite drink for ours lately.
That sounds delicious.
Yeah, it's really great. And it gives a little holiday spirit to it.
Absolutely.
And the question I have, though, is I'm seeing more and more herbs, and it bootstraps on what you were just talking about. I wanted to do something very herbal for a lot of herb in a drink coming up. So, one, what's the most popular herb to use in a drink, and a suggestion for one that has a lot of herb in it?
Well, I think I wouldn't say the most popular herb, but really the trend right now in mixology is all about culinary-style cocktails. So just, you know, as the trend in food is coming along, it's really about farm-to-table. So I would say go to your local, you know, fresh market or specialty store or something and pick out what is the best that day. Smell the cilantro, smell the parsley, smell the rosemary, and get creative. Just like you did with the cranberries, take your base spirit, which is your classic, and then just change it up a little bit.
It sounds to me like you could just enjoy yourself tasting a lot of different cocktails.
Absolutely.
What a great way to spend an afternoon.
And by the end of the day, maybe you'd have an idea.
Absolutely.
Or not. How does that help you, Ed?
Yes, it did. Thank you, and have a great New Year, everyone.
And to you, Ed.
Happy holidays.
Okay, so let's say you're going to have a party at home, and we want to set up a bar, a self-serve bar for everyone. What's your suggestion?
Well, for self-serve bars, again, like I said, it's all about presentation for me. You can win your guests over by catching their eye. So it doesn't have to be expensive. It just has to be beautiful. You know, take pride in the attention to detail as far as your plateware, your fresh ingredients, a lot of color. And I would go with a punch. That's the easiest thing to be self-served. You know, you can pre-make it. You can get a big, maybe a Pyrex dish and put some water in there the night before, make a big block of ice. So you have a big block of ice in your punch bowl and just put a ladle in there, cut some garnishes. If it's apples, then they'll stay their color, you know, with the citrus you have in the punch and everything. So they can just go up there and self-serve.
What would be kind of a simple punch recipe?
Well, one of my favorites is a Cointreau Autumn's punch. So apples and oranges go really nice together. This is super simple to make at home. I think I gave you the recipe
on
your website.
On the website.
And you have basically it's an ounce and a half of Cointreau, which is an orange liqueur made from bitter and sweet orange peels, all fresh. And then you have apple cider, some fresh squeezed lemon juice to balance out the citrus and sweet. and then you have some nutmeg and cinnamon. So you can just garnish it with cinnamon sticks. You can do fresh apple slices, some lemon wheels.
Is this what's in the bowl here?
This is what here.
Well, we're waiting for you to pour some out.
You're thirsty, I see.
Hello.
You know, I can smell that clear over here. That is very
aromatic.
Yeah,
she's sitting here with all this beautiful punch bowl with the fruit and slices, I think, of orange in it. And
so this is the most simple thing. You can really just, you know, leave it out, leave it with a ladle, and it looks gorgeous. It's appealing to the eye, and it tastes delicious as well.
Now I finally, Fred very nicely, has given me a glass of this punch. And,
cheers.
A nice strong flavor of cinnamon. And
this is a nice fall punch. You really want to bring out that spice and just bring all those flavors together.
Okay, and that's... And that's terrific. And then just...
Very nice.
We'll talk about... We're going to take a break soon, but we'll talk on the way back that you've brought some bar food to go with
Absolutely.
It. So you set up this pretty bar, and then you put some bar food around the room.
Absolutely.
And you
it's
just
all
enjoy
about
the
drinking
party.
And eating together.
Exactly. Well, I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and we're talking with Camille Austin. She's the head mixologist at Hakkasan Restaurant at the Fontainebleau Hotel on Miami Beach. We'll take a short break here, and we'll be back with more.
You're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and NPR for the Florida Keys, 91.5 WKWM. City Year Miami unites a diverse group of 17 to 24-year-olds for a year of service as tutors, mentors, and role models who make a difference to students and schools. You can learn more online at cityyear.org. City Year, give a year, change the world. It's 70 degrees currently in Miami. Overnight will be clear with a low of 57.
Ted Grossman from iTrain inviting you to listen this Sunday for our New Year's tradition, our world-famous New Year's Eve medleys, Sunday night at 8 p.m. on WLRN, WKWM, and WLRN.org. Happy New Year, everybody.
And we're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer.
Somebody's chewing.
And you caught me eating this wonderful bar food from Hakkasan Restaurant.
It is something to talk
my
about.
Guest is mixologist Camille Austin. We're talking about New Year's celebrations. She's been giving us some tips on setting up a New Year's Eve bar at home and also some ideas on what other drinks, cocktails, and the food that we're eating to go with the bar.
Man, this is good.
I happen to be having a lobster salad here with a little sauce on it, and then there's a little fried, there's some fritters made with rice and I think it's squash and goat cheese. Very nice. And by the way, I'm now on Twitter, and you can follow me at L. Gassenheimer. And Fred, you're on Twitter too? Are you
at
tweeting?
Fred Tasker Miami. I am tweeting on Twitter.
You're tweeting?
I think I got it right this time.
Who knows? How about you, Camille? Are you on Twitter?
I actually don't use Twitter that much. Every once in a while, I'm more into Facebook myself.
All right. Okay. Well, in these busy times, maybe you need a dinner in minutes. Here's a quick and easy one that's fun for this time of year. It's elegant. It's easy, and you could even use it for your for the holiday party if you wanted. It's sirloin steak in cognac sauce with saffron and pepper orzo, and really good. Did you like that, huh?
The orzo is delicious, yeah.
That sauce is nice. Cognac, huh?
It's really simple because...
What else besides cognac?
Okay, so you take the steak and you saute it in your skillet. Mm-hmm. About 2 minutes per side to just get it browned and then lower the heat for another about 6 minutes. 145 degrees and the temperature will be medium rare for your steak. And you take it off the steak out of the pan and you add cognac to the pan. And you've cooked that down and scrape up all the little brown bits in the skillet. And then I added some chicken broth, or you could add beef broth, and let that cook way down. and about in half. And then I added a little bit of Dijon mustard and a little bit of heavy cream.
Oh, mustard.
There we go.
Oh,
that helps to thicken it. Gives it a little bit of tang and then a little bit of heavy cream. And pour it over the steaks.
Boy, red meat and cognac. You can't go wrong.
All right. And then the side dish, you just cook up some orzo. And what I did was I cut up some red and green bell peppers into little squares. So you cook the orzo for about 7 minutes in boiling water. And just 2 minutes, throw in the peppers for about 2 minutes. Drain with olive oil and salt and pepper. So
orzo, it's very colorful. Orzo means barley in Italian.
Well, where did you pick up that piece of information?
On the internet.
But it orzo happens to be a rice-shaped pasta, is what it is.
Must be made of barley.
No, it is made of pasta. It's semolina flour. That's what it is.
So any much kind Wikipedia, of, I guess.
Probably barley semolina.
Did you
flour.
You really thought it was barley?
That's what it said, I think, on Wikipedia or something.
Well, you know,
it's got to be
accuracy
right
on the web. You know about that. Anyway, that whole recipe and a photograph's at dinnerinminutes.com. And also the recipes, the drinks recipes that Camille's been giving us is there. And Fred, can I guess what we're drinking for New Year's?
Well, with the New Year coming up, am I going to talk about bubbly? Maybe.
Yes, maybe.
Actually, as time goes on, our values tend to change. I know that just as I was getting out of college, I visited friends for New Year's Eve in the Bronx, and I tried to talk everybody into going down to Times Square to watch the ball drop, and they wouldn't do it just because it was sleeting and 31 degrees, so I was really bummed.
And you being, you were from Michigan at that time.
Yeah, I didn't know any better. These days, I spend New Year's with my mother-in-law and her and our set of friends who are of the age group that tend to know about all the great wars. You got World War II, World War I, Spanish-American, that sort of thing. So the real battle now is to get them to stay up until midnight in order to... But my best method for getting people to stay up is I open the cheap stuff, the bubbly, 9 o'clock, and I save all the really top champagne for I don't start pouring until Dick Clark starts counting down from 10. So that way you might get two or three people to stay up all the way to midnight. And you don't have to sell the ranch to get some good bubbly. I've got a couple of suggestions here. For $15, you can get the non-vintage Ana de Codorniu Brut Cava from Spain.
Say that again.
Ana de Codorniu. What you look for is just Codorniu. Codorniu.
Oh, that's the black bottle?
This is a white bottle.
Oh, this is the white bottle?
It's the same people, though.
Okay.
And it's only $15. Big soft bubbles, aromas of tropical fruit and minerals, that sort of thing. Or for really something to open at midnight, the 2002 Gloria Ferrer Royal Cuvée Sparkling Wine from Sonoma. This has lots of tiny bubbles and rich red fruit flavors and a long finish. It's really nice stuff for the stroke of midnight, and it's $32.
That's not too bad.
Yeah, so then I always end it with my yearly toast, champagne to my real friends and real pain to my sham friends.
All right. Well, actually, when I said that $32 wasn't bad, I mean, because some of the better champagnes can be up to hundreds of dollars.
Hundreds and $600 for some of the stuff,
That's a bit much. Well, Camille Austin, you brought us some bar food, and you've got an avocado in front of you. So is that going in the drinks?
No. It actually does go in a few drinks. Avocado and cocktails is for nice texture, as is egg white. But the avocado I brought you for a lobster avocado cocktail, really easy to make at home over here. You have the recipe on your website. And over here you have the butternut squash arancini fritters, which I absolutely love. Did you taste one already?
Arancini. Yeah, they are great. What is the arancini part?
Arancini means little oranges in Italian. I really love this. This is what I made to pair with our Cointreau punch, which is... you know, based by orange liqueur. So you have a little bit of goat cheese, orange zest, butternut squash in there, some risotto. They're absolutely gorgeous. And the topping is a nice honey infused with orange and basil. It's gorgeous.
So did you buy the honey already infused, or you just take honey and you put some orange and basil into the honey?
Well, actually, my good friend Jimmy Boy Elliott. He is a future restaurateur. He helped me put this together and actually did it at home. It's really simple to infuse. You know, you just let... It's all about the fresh ingredients. The fresher, the better.
And okay, the and better how long the does taste. It need to sit?
It depends. I like to do it by taste. If I'm working with a base spirit, then, you know, 15 minutes starting.
Okay, that sounds great. It's been a wonderful, tasty week. Camille Austin, thank you so much for coming.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Delicious foods, great drinks. You can taste her specialty drinks at Hakkasan Restaurant and at the Fontainebleau Hotel on Miami Beach. She'll be there. And I'd like to wish everyone listening a very happy New Year.
And that's our final Topical Currents edition for 2012. Thanks for your support and those who've pledged. We return next Wednesday, January 2nd, for a program with former New York Times reporter and editor Craig Whitney, author of Living with Guns, A Liberal's Case for the Second Amendment. Find free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org. We also have links and discussion to the Topical Currents Facebook page. That brings us to the calendar. On this day in 1900, 112 years ago, prohibitionist Carrie Nation smashes up her first saloon at the Carrie Hotel in Wichita, Kansas. She wasn't easy to stop. She stood 6 foot and 175 pounds. She died in 1911. And on this day in 1943, 69 years ago, the birth of NPR and ABC commentator Cokie Roberts in New Orleans. She's the daughter of the late House Minority Leader Hale Boggs. One more while we're consigned to the Peanut Gallery. On this day in 1947, 65 years ago, the first Howdy Doody TV show was broadcast, then called Puppet Playhouse. Buffalo Bob and crew produced some 2,500 episodes over 13 years. Happy and prosperous New Year to all our listeners from all of us here at WLRN. So we leave with a thought from Carrie A. Nation, whose name was trademarked in the state of Kansas. Quote, I felt invincible. My strength was that of a giant. God was certainly standing by me. I smashed 5 saloons with rocks before I ever took a hatchet. This is Joseph Cooper for Bonnie Berman. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.